Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Today is Friday, November 30th, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Jim McCarty is Carla's husband, the scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Please visit our websites, llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And the community website, bringforth.org, that's bring, the number 4, T-H, dot org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I will be asking Carla and Jim questions that come from you. If you would like to ask a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294, or you can join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty of LL Research. Hey, Carla and Jim, how are you doing today?
We're having a good time.
Doing good.
It's a time that's kind of sore on my heart because I'm going to have to say goodbye to Jim for, I don't know, 5 or 6 days tomorrow.
Heading to Nebraska to visit my mom for her 95th birthday.
Oh, my goodness.
Sunday.
Wow.
Yes. It's an annual trek, and this year there's going to be a little party at the assisted living facility where she is. So we're going to make it special and take her out to eat and come back and have cake and ice cream.
Okay. Well, you have a safe trip and have a lot of fun, and I'm sure there'll be lots of hugs.
Oh, yeah.
So, but Carla, oh, my gosh.
Mm. Yeah, this is the first time I haven't been able to go, and it's really, you know, I'm just so aggravated at my body because it just won't carry on well enough that Jim can get me there without a lot of worrying, and I'd probably be pretty sore, and there's no question about it. I didn't argue with him about it. It was kind of obvious. The trip to Philadelphia was nonstop, and it was a couple of hours. This trip is you have to lay over for a couple of hours in the middle of it. And one of the flights is, I don't know, an hour and a half. The other flight is over 2 hours. So it's more of a trek. And then you have to get in a rental car and drive about 3 hours.
Oh.
Not easy getting to Lexington, Nebraska.
Yeah.
So I had to stay here this year, and I'm hoping that the phone company will let him call me as much as he can.
Well, I'm sure it will.
I do fine without him, really, but in truth, we've been together for so long and alone, you know, apart from each other, very few days in how many years, Jim? 30?
32.
Yeah. That is a noticeable difference.
Well, don't feel bad. I'm a total wimp when it comes to long drives, and about 2 hours, which is from San Antonio to Houston, is about my limit. So we drove up to Fort Worth last summer, a couple of months ago, and that was, what, about a four-hour drive, and, oh, that totally maxed me out. It's like, I don't like doing that. So, and that's, you know, that's me, and you, with your situation, I can understand not wanting to go on such a long drive, really.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, you'll be fine, and, you know, like they say, about absence, right? So,
indeed.
You will. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and go to our opening riff, and unless y'all had anything else, any other announcements or anything.
That's
okay.
A big star in my sky right now. Go right ahead.
Okay, this is from Kuo, April 12, 1987. Let us take you back to the third grade, as this instrument would call it, within the school. The world was small. There was a desk, crayons, a teacher, a few friends, home, entertainment, and bedtime stories. The soul within was young and growing. You are that soul now, young and still growing. Growth does not lie in reacting to the circumstances about one, but rather in becoming more real than the illusion which you see all about you. And why are you more real than any other part of an illusion, which includes you? My children, there is such a thing as consciousness, because consciousness is that of the original thought of love, the logos which created all that there is. This logos dwells within and subjectively speaks to consciousness. Through consciousness, it speaks to the illusion. But without the pilgrims becoming aware of the need to remain unattached to the illusions of circumstance, it is very difficult to become an actor, a dramatist, and a critic, rather than one in the audience which reacts, laughing and crying as the scenes pass, the actors play their parts, and the flat painted scenery slides up and down. The source of reality must lie within the self, because reality is subjective, as consciousness is subjective. You are the creator knowing itself. You are also a pilgrim on the way to seeking the face of that creator. Yet, where do you seek? Do you not seek within? Where is buried the life within you that is unaltered, the consciousness that is infinite, the spirit that is eternal, but within your own heart and mind? Thus, the greatest service which a pilgrim can perform at any time is to be, that is, to be a conscious being, an actor, seeing circumstance as illusion, but illusion rich in spiritual possibility.
Thank you, Monica. When you listen to Kuo speak, it all sounds very flowing and almost poetic and easy to believe, but hard to put into practice, because we really don't see ourselves, for the most part, as actors who showed up to say our lines and perhaps create more lines while we're doing it. We tend to see ourselves as the audience. We tend to see things happening to us. And why shouldn't we see it that way? That's what it looks like. That's exactly what it looks like. It doesn't feel as though we are more real than what is happening around us. But we are. Or rather, the part of us that is consciousness is more real than anything else, except the part of everything else that is consciousness too. We are not those who simply are lost in the scenery, that flat scenery that rings up and down. We have the privilege of dancing with the other actors in our play, our passion play of every day. I was talking on the radio with a lady named Kathy Kirk, and she likes to think of everyone as ordinary heroes, because we all are heroes in the way that we have done something. It may not seem that we are, because we do so many things poorly. But generally, there are times in our life, there are moments in our relationship where we have truly been heroic and have been able to serve by being the one who kept his head, or who was able to give love, or who reached out and hugged someone that felt alienated. somewhere we made things happen because we were able to act. Seeing ourselves and that other self as the primary actors in the scene and not bowed by circumstance, but dancing with it. It's good to remember how young we are. It's good to hold on to that. We are not to be expected to be the all-knowing, all-wise, sixth density, Ra-like creature that we might like to be. We're doing well to keep our heads above water, metaphorically speaking, and breathe the air of good thoughts and the wisdom that spirit can bring. I was tuning up, as I do before every time that I speak or every time that I channel, and I could feel myself come together, knit together like it hadn't all day, because I hadn't done the work to bring myself to a higher and a better vibration. And I wonder to myself, why don't I do that every hour, every minute? Why do I wait until there's a special circumstance where I'm going to be put on the spot in the limelight? I think it's just that same feeling that we all have, that things are happening to us and they are bigger than we are. But oh, we are truly sons and daughters of the one infinite creator, children of eternity. And we hold that which is sacred within us. We don't even have to reach for it. It is closer to us than our breathing, than our bones and our muscles. What is it just to be? Can an actor come to the point where he is no longer acting, but simply is, like a force of nature? Like the eagle in the sky. I think that we can come to that moment of full stop and feel the essence of ourselves. If we only give ourselves the chance. Once a day, let's make a pact, you and I. Once a day, we will stop. We will let the play go on around us, that passion play of drama and circumstance. And we will be. And we will feel ourselves being, and we will remove all the masks that we can. Until we stand naked in the spotlight. This is who I am. This is the ground upon which I stand. I am love. Love. Love.
Thank you, Carla. Well, Jim, do you have anything to add to that?
Are you kidding?
Yes, I am, actually.
Yeah, I think that'll do.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. we're going to go to our first question tonight from Storm Shadow. And I want to remind everyone that you can call us. You can call us and get on the show live and ask your questions. Or if you just want to talk about something spiritual, you can call 646-595-2294. That's 646-595-2294. Be sure and hit the one key if you want to join the show. Okay, this is from Storm Shadow, which is a follow-up from a couple of weeks ago. Excellent response, Carla, Jim, and Monica. Thank you very much. Because Carla asked, I will provide more details. My discomfort lies with adding to the entropy of the situation. I know that in staying calm, I am preventing the total temperature of the interaction from rising too much or too quickly, and that is my primary motivation. Not getting angry is not so much a strategy to stay in my comfort zone as it is a discipline that I adhere to out of an awareness of the intensity of my own anger. I mean, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but I do not feel human when I'm angry. The only metaphor I can use to explain it is that I feel like a massive gravitative force, something that would eat a planet without any hint of emotion or remorse, only a calm knowing and acceptance that this is the next step and what must be done. I will begin speaking out loud the observations about people that I usually keep to myself because they're not ready to know these things that are being communicated. This scares people. Call it self-preservation, except that I see the two of us as the self. I know that I should give in to anger. I know that should I give in to anger, I may emerge from the argument correct, but our union will be put in jeopardy by the force of my emotion and the shock of what the other will interpret as a lack of care or compassion on my part. I actually enjoy being angry. It feels very pleasurable, seductively so, even, because I was not allowed to show anger as a child. Being angry is, unfortunately, very much in my comfort zone, and this is not something I'm terribly proud of. Being yelled at is what I do not enjoy, because it is illogical, a waste of energy, and in the case of people I love, a disappointment. I would have thought that they were better than that, that they were more aware of and in control of their baser impulses. I mean, I figured out that anger is non-constructive and set about regulating and controlling it in myself when I was 12. Why hasn't this person figured it out yet? What have they been doing with their time? Is basically where this behavior is coming from. So it may be out of fear of hurting the other self instead of a fluffy, feel-good love. But there is still quite a bit of sacrifice going on for the sake of the other. The reason I ask the question is that this is becoming my default behavior, and while the behavior is not changing, its reliability is becoming apparent. I'm not staying silent or disengaging. In fact, I'm taking every opportunity during the argument to express love and try and bring the other into this state of appreciation with me. But this just makes it worse because I realize that these statements of love, while what a perfectly STO individual would extend into the interaction, are precisely what a smart enough STS individual would also extend. And with this realization, I know that I am now actually controlling the situation by accepting it. So I feel that I've come full circle, so to speak. I'm becoming skillful, and perhaps this is simply me coming face to face with my shadow, and I should accept it, allow those polarities to coexist and balance each other out, and follow that path to wherever it leads me. Or should I give up the behavior that I chose in good faith service to the other simply because it could be seen simultaneously as an STS tactic? And if I do, would it not have to be in favor of a more ill-suited way of doing things simply for the sake of staying away from the mere possibility of being STS? This is what haunts me most recently. I feel that I'm becoming skillful at a lot of things having to do with my interactions with other selves, not just in the above case, but in everything. I notice small things I did not notice before, pauses in speech, eye movements, shifts in anxiety level, that sort of thing. I'm deconstructing coworkers psychologically in my spare time, almost as a reflex, making guesses as to their psychological makeup and dependencies, testing and getting confirmation, finding out what they seek most intently from others, and then giving it to them, out of the belief that this is the most appropriate thing to do for them, the best service I could provide. But one could then argue that I am also teaching them to depend on me. For example, I can tell which of them had less attention when they needed growing up, which had weaker than ideal attachments to their parents, which are looking for big brother figures, etc., and I feed them attention when they ask for it. And to my horror, this is working. I know I am doing this to help them, but at the same time, I also feel them putting more and more trust in me, thinking more and more highly of me, and entering into something resembling a growing sphere of influence. I feel that I am becoming able to shape people, and the sensation is perhaps too new and too heavy. And this is quite scary. I know that I could do extremely self-serving things with this if I wanted to. And thank God for the first time being, I don't feel tempted. For the time being, I don't feel tempted, but perhaps I do not trust myself completely. This is a new thing, and I may eventually feel an urge to open her up and see how fast she can go, you know? This is from Storm Shadow.
Jim, do you want me to start, or do you want to start?
Well, I'll make a start on it. It's a very complex question, and it's hard really to respond with any hope for accuracy without being face-to-face and being able to ask some questions. But I'll throw out a few thoughts. One of the things he said was that when he was a child, he was not allowed to express anger. And I'm wondering how that was done, if he could remember times when he was not allowed to express anger. Was it is that where the yelling came in and became such a thorn in his side and such a thing to be avoided? If there would be some way where he could remember what exactly was the method by which he was not allowed to be angry, and perhaps be able to reconstruct that in his own mind and by himself act it out again and this time become angry, I'm wondering if he would still have as much anger that he has to control when he's in relationship with others and not wanting to damage the relationship by expressing that anger and that type of honesty that would put a block perhaps between him and another person. I would need to have some sort of a response for him and to know what happened there. I'm also wondering if there is something pre-incarnative about the great anger. Does it go beyond the childhood? Is there a source for it that would be in another incarnation where he feels it's now necessary in this incarnation to try to handle that situation, which perhaps he did not handle well in the previous incarnation? That again would require some deep searching on his part to be able to find out if there is a source previous to this incarnation from which the anger came. And then in almost an unrelated avenue or vein, he also has the ability to sense into what other people are feeling and to respond to those feelings in such a way that they respond to him favorably and begin to become dependent upon him. This, again, seems like it could have some origination in a previous incarnation. And maybe this is the opportunity in this incarnation to work on that so that he does not use this ability in a service to self manner. And as far as his concern about being a service to self, it's his intention that really determines whether or not any particular action is service to others or service to self. So I would recommend that he look at his intentions when he is in communication with others and finding the ability to sense what they need and giving it to them. What is his motivation? I could see this being some way of being of service to others in that he would be able to focus in and tune in empathically, respond in a way that would be helpful to them. But again, that we would need to have much more input, face-to-face contact and some questions and answers back and forth. It's a very interesting question, very fascinating possibilities. Carla, how about you? You got any thoughts here? I'm sure you do.
You know me well. yeah, I do. When I get angry, I can't control it. On the other hand, it's not a matter of yelling. I don't believe I've ever yelled as a way of getting out of anger. What I've done is cry. When I get to the point where I just can't take it anymore, whatever that is, you know, why ever that is. I'm furious, but my reaction is all in tears. It's just, I sit there and I cry. It's totally useless, and I get madder and madder at myself because of that, but I can't help it. So I don't have any knowledge of what it would be like to control anger. I see it as a storm that's coming, and I just have to plow through it. And I do. I plow right through it, right straight through it. What occurs to me, and pardon me for dancing around this, but it's what occurred to me. Jim has the kind of anger that is a storm. It's quite destructive. It's amazing. It's a force of nature. He doesn't tend to get angry at me at all. He tends to get angry at things. The wallet that won't close right, the hammer that bent a nail, I don't know, it's something snaps, and he just loses it, and he doesn't hurt people. He hurts himself. He's been known to hurt himself, and he hurts things. He hurts things that mean a lot to him. He'll break the hammer, you know. Now, on my part, I have the tendency to speak the things that other people never speak because I don't have the kind of check in between my voice, my thinking, and what I say that most people have. I see something and I'll say it, and it just comes out before I think, you know, and it's true, and people are shocked by it. And then, because of the fact that I have not said it out of anger, but only like a little girl trying to understand something, you know, totally innocent, and Jim has got to speak here and say, you know, if I'm telling the truth, people come to see me as somebody to go to when they want to know the truth, because whatever happens, they know that it's a safe place, that I might say the truth, and it might be something difficult, but I'm right there with them to talk it out. And so there are elements of what you're experiencing in both Jim and me. And the one thing that I still see is that you are not seeing your wife as an equal partner. You are seeing your wife as someone that must be protected from your anger. And if I were your wife, I would feel very angry about that, and I would not allow that to continue. And I happen to have the ability to continue to speak very logically no matter how upset I am. And so we would undoubtedly have a series of very long talks, very, very long talks, and work it out so that you would feel free to express yourself to me the way you really are and not have such loneliness. I feel such loneliness in what you're saying, that you're sort of on Mount Olympus here because you're seeing so much more into what people are doing than they are. And you're able to, you know, give them what they need. You're not able to relate to them in a way that is equal. They can't give back to you because you're the great giver of all things. You know, I don't know how a person could help you to find a way to come into equal relationships with people that you see as being silly. Let me look back at what you said. You don't like yelling. You don't understand. You think that being yelled at is what I do not enjoy. Well, nobody enjoys being yelled at. My dad was in this situation of listening to my mother yelling at him the whole time they were married until about, age 50, when she finally got it that, you know, it wasn't worthwhile to yell at Daddy. And, you know, it was it was just not worthwhile at all. And so she developed the "you could be right, dear" approach, and of course this drove him crazy because he was trying to engage her in conversation. That was all it was. He was a guy that liked to think about everything, and the way that he engaged with people was to sort of brace them up. You know, what do you think about this? You know, and I can remember being very young, 3-4 years old, and sitting at the table and Daddy reading something out of the op-ed and saying, "Now, Carla, what do you think about this?" Now, the point is, I had to have an opinion. I couldn't sit there and say, "I don't know, Daddy." That was not acceptable. He'd say, "No, look, this is this, and this is this, and this is this." So I formed the ability very early to speak for myself and to have opinions and to think about stuff. So I think that was probably a very healthy way for me to grow up. But on the other hand, I do just say what's on my mind too much. So I'm not saying, you know, Jim and I have got something going here that's really great and you ought to find out how we do it, because I'm sure that you could poke tons of holes in the way we handle things. But the thing of it is, we've found a way to let each other cry and let each other be angry and break the hammer. And I think it's important to strive for a way to see your wife as equal to you, even though she is not capable of controlling the emotions of the moment. So few people can, you know, and I think it's because it was not allowed at home. And, you know, you were like in fear for your young life. You were not going to be accepted if you were angry, and so you learn to keep that all inside. But it was a terrible thing to learn. I'm thinking that, you know, it's an unhealthy thing in a very subtle and yet a very deep way. And is it really anger? Is it really crying? Is it really breaking the hammer? You know, there's so much illusion in what we do and how we express, and yet there's so much essence there. So how do you preserve the essence and love in the essence of people and yet find ways to relate in a more and more a transparent way? That would be my question to you. How could you do that? How could you find your wife to be equal even though she yells? My dad never found it true. And I remember one time I said, "Daddy, why are you so critical?" Talking about me. "Why are you so critical of me? You know, I had just worked really hard on something." And he looked at it and he said, "You know, that's not bad," he said, "but it would be better if you did this and this and this." And, you know, he just crushed me. And I looked at him. I said, "Why do you do that?" And he said, "Carla," he said, "of all the people in my family," he said, "you're the one that could possibly get it. And so I try harder with you to help you see, you know, how to be really excellent." And so he wouldn't engage with Mom, you see. That was the thing. He would get quieter and quieter while she yelled more and more. And finally, she'd blow up, and being careful to grab her cigarettes in one hand and her book in the other, God bless her, she'd race for the upstairs and go and spend the rest of the evening comforting herself with a good story. But, you know, that's really not the best way to handle it. And, you know, I see some parallels there. And he never understood it. He never could see why people didn't just say, "Well, what I think is, Ted, and what do you think?" You know, and just come back with, he loved to think. He never stopped thinking. And I remember one time after, Don was still alive. Don was still alive. But I was crying my heart out. And he heard me from upstairs. He was outside listening to jazz and watching the squirrel slide down the pole. He put oil on a pole and then put food up top. And the squirrels just, you know, slid down the pole. It was just fun listening to jazz, and he was getting close to death at that point and just still having a good time listening to jazz and watching the squirrel. And he said, I envy you. He said, "I've never been able to feel much, nothing good, nothing bad, just steady." He said, "I envy you the passion that you have, and I wish that I had it. So So how do you look at that? You know, how do you look at that? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I had been led to believe in other parts of my life that my crying was a bad thing simply because it stopped me from communicating. You know, I had to get the tears out of the way before I could continue to communicate. Okay, Mickey, wind it up. Whatever it is we've gotten here.
I don't know. I think we've come about as far as we can without getting some feedback from Storm Shadow.
Yeah. I do feel that that you're being real, and I thank you for that. And we're being as real as we can. So, yeah, carry on. If you want to take it further, we're right here.
Okay. We have another question from Cyan. Cyan says, I have an invention that I came across in my travels in the astral that would allow humans to build shelters that survive regardless of the worst possible planet-wide outcomes, such as nuclear war or a giant meteorite impacting the planet. Would such an invention produce, by your vision, more balance to the world, or would it produce more war, as it would enable the rich to escape from the consequences of the wars they may set in motion? Shelters would also work as houses or studios, power stations, transport, etc. I feel dirty asking such a physical world-related question here with such obvious power and control issues, but I hope that the question produces a good outcome. The larger question, which you may instead focus on if my specifics are too something, is that does helping STS entities secure themselves against their own fears help them polarize STO or STS?
I don't know much about STS. I think that beyond appreciating greatly the subtlety that STS is capable of in my own experiences with dealing with psychic reading, I really can't answer from that standpoint. I watched a lot of people build shelters in the 50s, more wealthy people that could afford it. And it didn't do anything except be reported on TV as a fad. And I don't really feel that there was much in that, the thing that showed, that made any difference. I think the real power and the real money were already very quietly and very secretly building not just shelters, but systems of a way to live under the surface of the planet and move from place to place under the surface, not just here, but in many, many other places as well, where there's a lot of civilization in Europe, you know, and in here. And that we'll never know, probably, just how incredibly safe that those with real power have the ability to be. I think that's beyond our ken, beyond our ability to know. There's so much that is secret about STS. It's almost a given that the more power and the more money, the more ability that there is to do precisely what you wish to do and make it a secret thing, something that the rest of the world doesn't know about. And there have been rumors since the Middle Ages, when the all the knights were battling, you know, the horrible Saracens, when there were agreements made between those of old money and those of old families, and, you know, a very tight-knit community that flies below the radar of anybody that... And, of course, there have been books written about these conspiracies, the Illuminati and all that stuff. People love this stuff. But I don't think they ever really get the whole of it. So what I'm saying about it is that you go ahead and make them available, because I think what's going to happen, if anything, is that it's going to be, you know, one more resource that people might have that don't have a lot of money. They could find at least a place to live that's maybe better than a trailer in a FEMA park, you know. So I think the spiritual point here is to be unafraid and to go ahead and give what you have to give. And be innocent, be childlike, and be positive, and say this is the best I can do to help the people work through this age. Mick, what do you think?
Well, I would agree basically with what you had to say. I know that in the case of the folks that suffered from Hurricane Sandy, I believe there were 34,000 people in New Jersey that were homeless. And they were looking for places to put them because in that densely populated area, they didn't have the situation that they had in New Orleans with a lot of space to put trailers and things. So they've been really pressed for finding a place to put people, just a space and place. So, in a situation like this, revolutionary type of shelter would be very handy. And, there are people all over the world that suffer one type of catastrophe or another, earthquakes or volcanoes or tidal waves or whatever, and they are put out of their homes. And shelters that would be economical and livable and sustainable would be very much in need there. So I think it would be a great thing to be able to do if there's some sort of a revolutionary idea that would make these more efficient than what we have now.
Monica, what do you think? You see anything that we've lost?
One little point that kind of jumped out at me, he asked the question, as it would enable the rich to escape from the consequences of the wars. So I'm wondering if this shelter that he's devised is something that's extremely expensive, and would that make a difference in your answer?
No.
Well, yeah, I imagine it would. If it's expensive, then it wouldn't be something that a lot of ordinary people would be able to afford, especially if they didn't have homes or money.
So if he's asking the question, if this particular device is something that would only be utilized by the wealthy or the power elite, then what kind of service would he be offering if he made that available to those people?
Well, I just think that would be redundant. I think that the people in that kind of power already have it taped, in case of a difficulty. They know exactly what they're going to do, and they've got it worked out. It would be redundant. So I still don't think it would make a whole lot of difference. I could be wrong. I could be terribly wrong.
Okay. Yeah. Any other comments, Jim? Or
no, that's it.
Okay. All right. The next question is from Lightworker. Am I creating negative outcomes for myself through this? For the past few years, when I pray, call on angels, try to create positivity around me, I feel that I'm drawing negative intention to myself. I know when you shine your light, you're more likely to attract darkness, but it seems that no matter how much light I emit, the darkness never descends. This past Monday was a very important day for me that I've been waiting for quite a few years. I found myself internally praying, but negative images were flashing in my mind throughout my positive thoughts. It's almost like I was receiving blockages in image form. Anyway, my day went extremely opposite of what I was hoping and planning. After review, I feel that I may have drawn negative energy to myself without knowing, or maybe I was tapping into the outcome, knowing it was going to go poorly. This is from Lightworker.
What do you think, Mick? My first response, and I don't know if it's a good one, is my memory of when I first tried to meditate. I felt quite ill when I would try to meditate, and I couldn't shake it for maybe a half a year. And after that, I started seeing negative entities. They were like boogeymen, and it was like they were trying to scare me. And every time I went into meditation, this would happen. And I persisted, and I went on with it, and I got through it eventually, and I didn't have that happen to me. And it took me probably a couple of years to get to the place where I was able to navigate into a more deep space where I was able simply to hold the space and just allow. And it was a safe space. So my first impulse is to think that perhaps as you continue to make meditation and prayer a daily habit, that you will outgrow these experiences. To get into exactly why this happens, I think that you have to look at who occupies the lower astral planes of the, you know, of our planet. It's full of the boogeymen that we create because, you know, Hollywood, and before Hollywood, you know, folk tales have always had scary figures in them that would come and terrify, you know, good little boys and girls. And they're thought forms. They're basically thought forms. They're living in the lower astral. And every time somebody has a scary thing, it feeds into one or the other of these thought forms. So I think that was what was happening in my experience, was that I was simply not getting above the lower astral planes of the unseen, and I was just sensitive enough that I was moving into the unseen and seeing some of it, and it was like that was what I was seeing.
It might also be helpful to send this positive energy that's being created in the meditation to whatever negative image seems to be attracted to the effort. Make that a part of the practice so that whatever negativity comes your direction is bathed in your love and light. And this is something that usually provides not only a shield for protecting against further intrusions, but it reinforces the positive generation of energy that you're making there in that meditative effort. So I would suggest just incorporate the negative greetings into your meditations and send love and light to them.
That's very good advice, Jim. That was the advice Ra gave to us. Wasn't it at one point that we would send love to the negative entity and send love to the whole, to the situation, send love to the situation, and send love to ourselves as well.
Right. And that allowed you to continue on with what you were doing and provided a shield to protect you and also blessed the entity as being part of the Creator and not reacting in fear, because fear is a way of moving away from what you really are intending to do and adopting the negative entity's playground, shall we say, their rules of the game.
That's true. So I think it's entirely possible that, excuse me, Monica, it's entirely possible that a person could be so full of power, you know, spiritual power, that simply, you know, that it was impossible for this entity to pray without attracting all of this. But I think it's more likely that, like most everybody, we're just not standing that close to the light, that this is the answer. I think this is not the answer that you've come up with, light worker. I think that the answer is more like, if it's not, you know, coming from outside yourself, it might be part of your shadow side that feels that it's dying because you're doing these things. And, of course, it is dying. The part of you that is on the opposite end of, you know, this polarity, you're leaving it behind, and that means you know it will die of starvation because of lack of attention. So there's a lot more feeling like this is generated from within the personality than from without, you know, from psychic greeting. Most everything that people talk about, you know, in general, is coming from within the self rather than from without the self. And I know certainly my experiences of myself, that is true. And I'm one who thinks I really have had psychic greeting from the outside in. But I think most of what I experience is coming from the part of me that I'm endeavoring to move away from. Monica, what did you have to say?
I was just going to clarify, you wouldn't recommend that he quit his spiritual practice or quit meditating or praying in the way that he is, right?
No, I wouldn't. I'd say go right on. Be steady and hold on to your conviction that this is the right thing for you to do. And as you are steady with it and daily with it and, you know, give it space in your life, it will more and more give you what it is that you're seeking, you know, that safe place to go, that house of prayer that lies within.
Okay, you mentioned thought forms, and that actually leads into our last question for the evening. What is a thought form? I mean, we talk about it a lot, and this is actually a kind of a composite question that I put together from several topics on the forum. Can a thought form be a sliver of the personality split off because of trauma and taking on a life of its own? Like, for example, you've heard of, you know, children that were severely abused, and yeah, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, can that be actually a thought form that becomes like an entity unto itself? And I know I've heard of shamans working to release and clear thought forms, or in other cases, reintegrating them back into the person they came from. Is this what ghosts are, slivers of the personality that stayed behind as a thought form? And how do you get rid of negative thought forms?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's what ghosts are. As far as I understand it, ghosts are a personality shell that's left behind. You know, we think that our personality is such a big part of us, and a lot of us are moved greatly by ego concerns. But that is one thing that we shed when we go from this life to a greater life, is that personality shell. It's something that we've created for this life only. And we take the things that are essential to us with us. We take what we came in with away. But we leave the personality shell, and it follows well in our personality if our karma is balanced with people, and if we're you know, having a good rocking time and we love the work that we're doing and so forth. We're never going to leave a personality shell behind because we're happy dudes, and that personality shell will just disintegrate. There's no need for it to hold together. But sometimes, and I've experienced this one time, when I was, Don had just moved in with me and we were just starting L&L research, and I was in this new apartment that I'd gotten because I knew Don wanted to move in with me after my divorce from my starter husband was final. And nobody had ever slept in that bedroom before, and every time, well, I had slept in the other bedroom, so I was moving from one bedroom to the other. So I was now sleeping in a new bedroom when he came in. We had two separate rooms. So I was sleeping apparently now in the room that she slept in, or that her son slept in, one, I'm not sure which. But at any rate, I started in the time between you are awake and you go to sleep. Jim, what's that called?
The preconscious.
Yeah, or, well, there's another word for it too. I can't think of it right now. At any rate, in that state, I would get flashes, like, you know, this woman saying, "You've got to help my son, and I'm so upset about this, and I'm, you know, terrified, and please help me." And it was very shaking, you know, and it didn't ever get any better. You know, that was just the message every single time. And every single time that I was in that state starting to go to sleep, I wouldn't go to sleep, I'd be awakened, you know, because of the horror in her voice. And so I decided to check it out. So I asked around, and this poor woman had had a son that was in and out of trouble. She was a single mom, and he had gone bad and had been in and out of jails for the young, and he had just graduated to the point where he was to be tried as a grown up for some sin that he had done. I don't know what it was. And he had to go to a big old jail, and she had been worried about this when she died. And that was the point at which she left him. So I was able to find out that he went through his sentence okay, and he was out now, and he was doing better. This is from a very nosy neighbor. God bless nosy neighbors when you need to know something. And so when I got in hypnagogic, that's what I was trying to think of. When I got into the hypnagogic state again and she came to me, I talked to her and I said, this is what I found out, and he's really okay. And I'd really appreciate you're not coming around anymore because, you know, he's okay. He's not here anymore. You've gone on. You need to let your true self, you know, be healed and move on because all of this is done and you need to just relax. You're not alive now and you need to let go and go ahead and go into larger life. Well, it was okay. I mean, she stopped being so worried about her son, but there was just this feeling around that was, you know, she was just a very unhappy woman, and I was continuing to be bothered. And what Don did was typical country. He grew up in Mayfield, Kentucky, which is about as country as you get. And what he did was he just put a revolver in the bed and left it there for several days, one time when I was going to be away. And that's what she got, is the revolver. And she somehow understood that symbol, and she didn't bother us anymore after that. So it was a mixture of consoling the thought form and telling the thought form to go away. So thought forms are forms that are created when we focus on something to the point where it is an obsession. The old philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and so forth, felt that the virtues were thought forms and the sins were thought forms, that there was a place higher than we were where perfect beauty, perfect truth, perfect justice, and so forth existed in an ideal state, in a much more regular state than we could ever think of here. And those were thought forms. But in terms of the Akashic and Devakanic planes, the lower planes of the astral world that is around our planet, the thought forms are created in the negative sense by people worrying about things and being obsessed by things. And so a lot of thought forms are not pleasant. There are also people that are obsessed with truth, with beauty, with justice, and so they move into the positive thought forms and create more thought forms. There are masters that have such essential beauty to their being that they, by not even meaning to, they create a thought form of themselves. And the gurus, you know, are seen and re-seen and seen and seen after they die, not just by their students from when they were alive, but students that they see, that see them because they've come into the vibration where they need that master to speak to, and then they become students of that particular guru, that particular master that is on the inner planes. Jim, you want to say anything to that? That's basically what a thought form is anything that you can think of by thought. The Confederation people say that, you know, when they came to us, they came not in a spaceship, but in a thought form. That they, you know, thought to create the way from there to here, and they moved from there to here in a thought form. And that what we're seeing when we see the positively oriented UFOs, is not physical, but spiritual. It's from the metaphysical realm, and is not. It does not have mass. Does not have any kind of physical being, but rather is a thought form.
Ditto. Yeah, I think that any time we concentrate upon a thing or a thought obsessively or over a long period of time, we give it a certain kind of reality. And on a certain level of being, it does exist.
Okay, we are actually out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up here. And we did get a couple of questions, a question from the chat room, but we'll have to do that next week. Okay, Carla and Jim, thank you so much for the show as usual. It's always some really good information. And to our listeners, you've been listening to In the Now with Carla and Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Check out llresearch.org and bringforth.org. That's bring, the number 4th.org. You can submit questions. We're here every Friday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. We'll see you next week.